Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, where we continue our look at the climate change policies of the main political parties in the UK. Are they anywhere near the scale of the task demanded by the science? This week, our focus is on the Conservative Party, who, under the leadership of former PR man David Cameron, have used the issue of climate change as part of their rebranding or detoxification process. Whether this was a cynical move or not, it helped maintain the profile of the issue in the mainstream media. However, the assessment of the environmental NGOs in the UK last month in their Green Standard report is that Tory policies and commitments on climate change have been slow in coming and insufficient to match the initial rhetoric. Conservative policies on the environment, they conclude, are neither deep nor broad enough. The Green Standard report also notes what they call the uncomfortable truth, that a third of Tory MPs who responded to a survey earlier this summer questioned the existence of climate change and its link to human activity. Also, in London, the recently elected maverick Tory mayor, Boris Johnson, appears to be rolling back and deprioritising the relatively progressive climate change policies brought in under the previous mayor, Ken Livingstone. If climate change is as important to David Cameron as he claims, why is he not insisting that Boris Johnson take more of a leadership role on this issue in London? I spoke to Zach Goldsmith, who is a former editor and current director of The Ecologist magazine, and also the Conservative Party parliamentary candidate for Richmond Park, who last month was called by Greenpeace as an expert witness in the trial of the King's North Six. Most significantly for this programme, back in 2006, he was invited by David Cameron to co-chair the Conservatives' Quality of Life Policy Review. The 500-page review was published last September and made numerous recommendations across all aspects of the environment. It's important to note that not all the recommendations that Zach discusses in the following interview have been taken on as official policy by the party. To try and find out exactly what the Tory party policy is on various aspects relating to climate change, I've been looking at the policy section on the website.
Yeah.
And it all seems to be fairly sketchy. I mean, some sections have just a couple of paragraphs. Some sections have additional policy papers to back them up. But yeah. But a lot of it is fairly thin on the ground. Working down from the international level, for example, I can't see any reference to how the Tories would approach the UN climate talks. There's no reference, therefore, for example, to supporting even the currently widely endorsed target of 2 degrees maximum rise in global temperature, let alone any mention of James Hansen's latest work on targets, for example, which suggests that the tipping point lies at a much lower level.
The Conservative Party position on international targets and carbon caps and so on has got to be based on whatever the science says, and we've said that consistently. So, I mean, that's why a lot of emphasis has been put on the Climate Change Committee. Our view is that whatever the science tells us has to be our target. It can't be politics-led, it's got to be science-led. The science is changing. You know, a few years ago, 60% seemed like the right figure. Now the science seems to be moving closer towards a sort of 70 or 80%. Some people go further. The science has to be the thing that creates the targets for policymakers, and not vice versa. There are very few people in Parliament who understand climate science, who really understand it, and for that you have to rely on the climatologists, which is why what's important is that the Climate Change Committee has real power. It can't just be an advisory group. I think we should aspire to have something closer to what they have in Denmark. They've got a climate minister, which it looks like we might be moving towards here, a climate minister who has absolute access to pretty much all corridors of power in the Danish government. So the finance minister, for example, before issuing a budget, will have discussions with the climate minister. And the effect is that you've got a sort of green thread weaving its way all the way through decision-making in Denmark. That's what we need here. And it's crucial that we end up with the right person in charge of that committee and that the committee has, you know, has the right people on board. And if you get that right, then I think we're going to, you know, that will determine policy, that will shape policy. But we do talk about listening to the science, and the science is telling us 80%. That's what we're going to have to try and achieve.
In terms of the type of deal that the Conservatives would support at the international level, again, there's no indication on the website. Are you going to support a continuation of the current failed Kyoto regime, or would you consider alternatives such as contraction and convergence or Oliver Tickell's Kyoto 2 proposal?
Well, I mean, it's a discussion. It's incredibly complicated how you allocate carbon. Do you do it on the individual level? Do you do it at the level of the corporation? Do you do it at the national level? Probably a mixture of all these things. It's incredibly complicated, and I don't pretend to know which formula works best. But the key, I think, is the national target. And the first starting point, I think, for us as a country is to make sure that at the level of Europe, at the level of the EU, we have an ETS scheme that works. And that means not over-allocating carbon. It means setting targets, setting the cap at such a level that you have a proper price in place. And one of the problems with ETS is there was more carbon allowance granted than was needed. And that was as a result of individual countries basically putting forward a wish list. And the perverse effect was that a lot of energy companies ended up actually making windfall profits from free allocation. So you've got to change all that. You know, we have talked consistently about full auctioning, for example, which I think is a crucial first step, and actually ensuring that the carbon cap is set by science and, again, not by opportunistic politicians.
Surely the biggest loophole in the EU ETS is the linking directive, which allows countries within the EU to purchase emissions credits from abroad and not make emissions reductions at home.
Yeah, I mean, that is a problem, but you've got to find the line between allowing countries to offset and actually being forced to make changes at home. And there is a line there, because if the offset mechanism, theoretically, and I know this is not the case at the moment for all kinds of complicated reasons, but theoretically the offset mechanism is quite a useful way of redistributing wealth throughout the world, potentially. What it can't become is an excuse. So it shouldn't be the primary mechanism governments can use to meet their targets. It should be ancillary or secondary, and that's important. Now, I think the debate at the moment in Parliament is that the figure should be around 25%, and I think that's about right. I mean, there is no correct figure. There is no science that backs that up. It means that 75% of our target has to be met here, and by offsetting the remaining 25%, hopefully, theoretically, that money will be flowing into very useful projects around the world. Now, I'd like also to see, I mean, this is one of the things that one has to hope will happen at the next round of negotiations, that standing forests will become part of the carbon market somehow. And I know there are all kinds of problems with that, but I think it seems to me a pretty straightforward truth that forests, if we're going to save them, have to be worth more alive than dead, and that is not the case at the moment. The Amazon, as a whole, as far as I know, is worth less than Google. We can't live without the Amazon. We have no economy without the Amazon. Clearly, Google is little more than just a convenient service. So we got it wrong, fundamentally wrong. And somehow we have to find a way of bringing forests in. I hope that'll happen at the next round. That's something we're going to be pushing for. It's incredibly complicated and all kinds of risks associated with it. But as a mechanism, I don't think there's anything else on the table which will solve that. But the problem it is, from a climate perspective, protecting what remains of the world's forests is pretty high on the list, if not the top. So I think that's got to be a big part of the negotiations. But yeah, so I think the ability by countries to offset 25% of their obligations is probably about right, as long as the money flows into the correct projects.
Okay, I'm not sure you get the 25% figure from.
There is no agreed figure, but that if there was an agreed figure between the Liberal Democrats, for example, and the Conservative Party, it's around 25%.
I mean, I just looked at the amendments today that have been tabled for the climate change bill. The Lib Dems are asking for 50% cap, and the Tories are asking for 60% effort has to be made at home.
So 40%.
Yep.
I mean, I still think 40% is too high, but there's a difficulty there, and it's in the interest of the government. Clearly not the interest of the wider population or indeed the environment, but it's certainly in the interest of the government to create as big a loophole as possible, and that's what effectively that is. So presumably the compromise then is around 40 to 50%. But if we really want this thing to be effective, I think it should be, you know, we should really be pushing for 25%. But it may be that negotiations have broken down around that level, and 40% is the compromise. I suspect that's probably the case. 40% is not a disaster, as long as the money is actually used for something useful. Now, you know, if that 40% helps contribute, for example, to ensuring that we're not losing 13 million hectares of forest a year, then that's very useful. And probably in terms of bang for your buck, you can achieve more by spending that money overseas on those kinds of projects than you can at home. So I think the principle is good. The question is where the level should be. For me, I think it's more like 25%, but 40% isn't a disaster.
The Tyndall Centre have pointed out, Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes, for example, pointed out that the climate bill should really recognise the need for immediate action on demand. I think they were suggesting that perhaps, for example, At one point, there was an inclusion of the option of tradable energy quotas being legislated for. I think that's been removed now. But the point that the Tyndall Centre are making remains is that we need immediate action to tackle demand. And they say that we need to acknowledge that reliance on low carbon supply alone is misguided, because it's not going to happen in time. We need urgent action, and the only way to do that is to drive behaviour change with some form of demand management. So I don't see any mention, either in the Quality of Life Review or the Conservative Party's policies, about tradable energy quotas. What we have in terms of demand is a kind of weak commitment to carbon taxes.
But no, that's not true. The Quality of Life Review and much that has come out of the Conservative Party is focusing on demand, on energy efficiency. I don't think it's so much about behaviour change. It's much more about a systemic change that enables people to live lives that aren't so energy intensive. Now, how do you do that? Our job in the Quality of Life Review was to try and find easily identifiable levers that the next government could trigger, which would lead to rapid reductions in the amount of energy being used. It's not all. We have one chapter on energy supply, and we have a great big section on energy demand. And the energy demand section is the area that is easiest for any government, because it's obviously the best power plant is the one that you don't need to build, because you've reduced demand for it. That, in fact, I think was our starting point in that section. So, our job was to try and find those levers which would lead to the biggest reduction in the amount of energy being consumed in this country. Now, for example, we talked about big stamp duty rebates on homes that were passed on in the best environmental condition. Now, if the cost of upgrading one's home is smaller than the rebate that one would enjoy from this mechanism, then I think it becomes a no-brainer for homeowners. It becomes an investment decision rather than an ethical decision. And given that houses change ownership on average every 7.5 years, I know that averages are misleading in this context, but if that's the case, then theoretically we could have a clean housing stock in a relatively short period of time. The home is responsible for about, if you include building the home, for about 60% of our emissions in this country. So it's a pretty good place to start. Similarly, in transport, our view is that you scrap existing initiatives and you come in with a much more bullish approach, which says that at the point of purchase, i.e. when it actually counts, if you're going to buy a car that is very energy inefficient, you're going to pay a great big purchase tax, but that all of that money is going to be used to bring down the price of the cleaner cars. I think those are the kind of mechanisms which we have identified and which are being absorbed by the Conservative Party, and those are the kinds of mechanisms which will lead to demand reduction.
You moved on to transport. The shadow minister has announced there'll be no third runway at Heathrow, which is welcome. But you recommended that there should be a moratorium on all planned expansion. That has not been taken up by the mainstream party. And there's no significant tax to stabilise or reduce demand on aviation. And in London, instead of expanding Heathrow, Boris Johnson wants to build a new airport on an island in the middle of the Thames. So
I don't see that happening.
So we're just taking one issue there, and there's no evidence that a low-carbon future for aviation is going to happen under the Tories.
Well, I mean, it's a ludicrous thing to say that. The Conservative Party have said that there will be no expansion of Heathrow. That's a major step forward, and shows that the Conservative Party is serious and has the courage to do what is necessary. So this is a big issue, and I don't think many people would have expected that to have happened. It has happened. That's good. It's not just a block on Heathrow expansion, though. It's more than that. We've talked about and have come up with plans for an extensive high-speed rail network. It's just the beginning. We need much more than that. But I think that shows that we are pointing at a very different future in terms of transport. Yes, we recommend a moratorium on airport capacity, and I think that's what we need to do. I think it's actually, if you start dealing with the fact that a huge proportion, not the majority, but a huge proportion of flights in this country are domestic, or they're to destinations you can already get to, albeit more expensively and less comfortably, by train. So our obligation, and this is what we say in our report, and the Conservative Party has taken this on board, is to improve the rail network. But it's not just a climate change issue, it's beyond that. There's huge pressure for development in and around London, and that's because we are among the most centralised countries in Europe. If you actually had a decent transport network, one based on clean rail, then it would be much easier for businesses to relocate in parts of the country that are currently being abandoned. So in terms of genuine broad environmental impact, a proper rail network will do a hell of a lot. It'll redistribute activity throughout the country. It'll relieve pressure in terms of housing and so on, and increasing infrastructure in London. And it'll have the added impact of reducing flights, which opens to 2 million people living under the flight path. whose lives are blighted by the noise of aircraft. So to say there's no evidence at all that we're rethinking the government's transport vision, I think that's clearly not the case.
Okay, in terms of rail, we're talking about one high-speed rail line which runs from Leeds, Manchester, Birmingham to London. It won't start until 2015 and it won't finish until 2027. It's not clear how that would be funded, even. Are you expecting the private sector to fund that?
Well, I don't know about the funding mechanism. I mean, that's for the Treasury to work out. How is this funded? It's going to have to be worked out. I don't know. It's not something I've been involved in.
Okay.
But it's a commitment. It's a pledge, and we'll find a way.
On the policy section for transport also, again, it's very brief. On the one hand, it talks about focusing on improving public transport and providing people with viable alternatives to car travel. It's not clear how that would happen. But in the paragraph before, it talks about building new roads to tackle congestion. So, again, there's a clear contradiction here. The same problems appearing that have happened with Labour about one department doing one thing and some other policy coming from somewhere else.
You can't commit to never building any more roads. There are areas where bottlenecks have built up and will need to be relieved.
Surely we need to pretty much eradicate private transport, run it down very significantly.
We're not going to eliminate private transport. And in the real world, I think everyone has to accept that that's the case. And there are plenty of people whose lives are dependent on cars. So what do we have to do then? We have to try and create a planning system which reduces the need for travel. We need to learn from companies like BT, for example, which have made a lot of use of technology and as a result have massively reduced the air and road miles of their employees, dramatically so. We need to use some of the more effective localized schemes, as used, for example, in Paris and Lyon, which have massively increased uptake and use of bicycles. The Cyclo City in Lyon is extraordinary. Similarly in Paris, we need the same sort of schemes here. We need to make better use of, in London, for example, of the River Thames to move freight around instead of clogging up the roads with huge supermarket trucks. The American-style yellow bus scheme, for example, has massive impact in terms of getting people out of cars and onto buses, and it's good for children, it's good for parents, and it's good for the schools. The children turn up in a state of mind which allows them to go straight into the classroom without disruption. I mean, there are lots and lots of little, in some cases quite grand, initiatives which will have that impact. But, it's each to their own. Some communities are going to have different solutions to others. But it's a question of really prioritizing this and pushing it and making it possible. In terms of the cars that will remain, we need to have a clear tax incentive for people to buy those cars which cost a lot less to run and use a lot less fuel. In Denmark, this is exactly what they've tried. It's now more expensive to buy a dirty car and it's cheaper to buy a cleaner car. And you can see the effect through the sales of the respective cars in Denmark. It works. And we need to follow that. We need to do it. And we've got to make sure that the discrepancy is big enough that it actually has an impact. But, there's an awful lot to be done. But you do need to, rather than coming up with endless original new ideas, I think actually the easiest thing to do is to look around the world at those places that have got it right and pinch the best ideas. That's the beauty of best practice.
I mean, some of the things you mentioned there are in the Quality of Life Review but haven't been adopted officially as party policy. You must be frustrated or disappointed by the way in which most of your policies have been ignored, your recommendations rather.
There's a media narrative which you've bought into. Which is that the quality of life ideas have been rejected. But actually, that's not true. I think there are two ideas that I can think of from the Quality of Life Review which have been rejected. One of them was to add VAT to the cost of air travel. But in our report, we suggest that the only reason for wanting to do that would be to raise money to create alternatives, to invest in rail and so on. If there are other mechanisms available for investing in rail, then I'm very happy with that. Another idea that was rejected was charging or allowing local authorities to charge the supermarkets for their free parking as long as they used that money to reduce the cost of activity and parking on the traditional shopping areas. Now, I happen to believe that that's a useful idea, but it's not a deal breaker. It's not crucial. There are lots of ideas within the report which are truly important, and they have not been rejected. In fact, a large number of them have been accepted. Now, the difficulty with a party that is probably 18 months away from the next general election is it has to decide which ideas to release now and which ideas to hold on to in the run-up to the election. Now, that's not my business. That's the business of the central office of the Conservative Party, and I'm not going to argue with that. But on the key issues, we are moving rapidly in the right direction. So energy, for example, we've come up with a position on clean coal, which more or less mirrors that of Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, which says that we would not build any coal power plants in this country that don't meet the standards of a modern gas plant, which is, I think, progressive. I think it's the right thing to do, and I think it puts the government in a situation where it's going to have to think very, very seriously about its own plans for reintroducing coal into this country. On decentralized energy, we are saying that we would like to move to a situation closer to that of the Netherlands, where more than 50% of their heat and power comes from small-scale decentralized energy units, which are vastly more efficient than our own energy infrastructure and vastly cleaner and cheaper. So we're talking a lot about that. We have pledged to introduce feed-in tariffs, which will encourage, hopefully, an explosion of investment and interest in microgeneration, which is the effect that feed-in tariffs have had in Germany. There's one town in Germany with 200,000 people produces more energy from microgeneration than the whole of Britain. They've got about 10 times more people employed in that sector than we do in this country. So it's not the case that the report has been ignored. It is the case that the party is making its way through the report and introducing ideas and pledges, and will continue to do so for the next 18 months. You know, we're at the beginning stage. You know, we haven't even got to food and farming, or even marine, which is a massive area, but where there is no conflict within the party about what needs to happen, we just haven't got there yet.
Well, we look forward to more announcements. By the way, that's not a media narrative that I've bought into. That's the assessment of the leading environmental NGOs in this country in the Green Standard report, which expresses disappointment in what they say has been the sidelining of the quality of life review.
But where's the evidence?
I've got the 29-page executive summary in front of me of your submission to the Shadow Cabinet. I've been through that over the last few days, and I've checked it against what's on the Conservative Party website, so I'm not going on other people's assessment. I've kind of seen it for myself.
If you think that one of the main sections is energy, all of the key ideas that we've introduced there on party pledges, more to come. You know, we haven't pledged, for example, to introduce a heat levy, but there is no better mechanism, I think, other than rearranging the planning system for encouraging decentralized energy. If you say that a power plant is going to pay a levy on waste heat that it generates, from the future, this is not retrospective, there's no point applying this to plants that already exist, but the effect is that when it comes to making investment decisions, you're going to be more likely to want to invest in a decentralized energy infrastructure. There are all kinds of details of that sort which are making their way into the party manifesto. We're not headline grabbers.
On the, again, the energy policy page, it talks about, okay, no blank check for nuclear, but it does talk about we need to maintain a long-term climate for investment, which presumably means some kind of subsidy.
No, the Conservative Party has ruled out, Alan Duncan explicitly has ruled out subsidies for nuclear power. I mean, some people believe that nuclear power can exist without subsidies, other people don't. I personally don't, not least because there has never been a nuclear power plant built without government support, without government subsidies. And, you know, if others feel differently, well, then we'll let the market decide. But my view, and the view of most people who have been campaigning on this issue of nuclear power for many years, is that without subsidies, there is no nuclear power.
The idea of public investment is pretty much in complete contradiction to Conservative Party philosophy. Would you agree with that?
In what sense?
Well, David Cameron talking about small government in his closing speech, saying that the current crisis shouldn't be responded to with, you know, larger government. And I mean, basically, how we got out of the last depression in the 1930s was by A, re-regulating the financial sector, and B, investing in public goods. Well, I think this is important because this is about what we do next.
This is a discussion about climate change and the broader environment. But in terms of government involvement, no, there's never. The Conservative Party are not fanatical free marketeers. You know, Margaret Thatcher, when faced with the problem of the ozone hole, and at a time when the Montreal Protocol was being written up, and she played a pretty big role in that, she said, never call me laissez-faire. The government's got to be willing and able to do those things which only government can do. You know, it doesn't matter how far you go back. Some of the most interesting and useful environmental legislation has been passed by Conservative governments. So, yeah, there have been moments where Conservatives have not wanted to interfere at all. There have been other times in our history where we have. I think it depends on the issue, it depends on the circumstances, and it depends on the approach. But I don't think there's a contradiction between what I'm saying now and David Cameron's aspiration for a smaller, lighter government. I'd like to see that too. I think our regulatory approach in this country is wrong, and I think it needs to be turned on its head. But that doesn't mean less regulation, it doesn't mean more regulation, it means better regulation. It means allowing, creating a situation where instead of endless government prescriptions on every single form of economic or human activity, you actually create a situation where innovation is possible. You have an outcome-based approach as opposed to a process-driven approach. You know, trusting people to do the right thing, and if they get it wrong, being willing to come down on them. That's the approach that works best, and that is, in my view, absolutely in line with what David Cameron said in his speech to the party conference and before and after.
I mean, basically, we're not going to see a Tory government, if the Tories got into power, we're not going to see massive public investment in energy efficiency and green technology as a way of stimulating the economy and kind of tackling what is really a triple crunch of the credit crisis, peak oil and climate change. I mean, and this isn't just something that's coming out of, you know, the Green New Deal coalition. This has been argued by Nicholas Stern in a lecture just the other week. And the United Nations Environment Programme are about to launch a plan along these lines sometime this week. So, but as I say, that goes against the grain of Conservative Party philosophy.
I totally disagree. I think it depends what you mean by massive investment. If the Conservative Party can create a framework in which it becomes possible and likely that a huge amount of money will flow into clean technology, then we'll have done a service. And there's a hell of a lot that can be done using the regulatory system and using the tax system to make that happen. That's our job. I mean, the feed-in tariff approach, if the experiment is repeated that we've seen in Germany, will lead to an explosion in clean technology at the micro level in this country. If we introduce a heat levy and change the planning system in favour of small-scale decentralised energy, then similarly money will flow into those areas. You know, if we change the tax system on cars in such a way that the cleanest and best cars are cheaper than the dirtiest cars, then that's where the money will flow and companies will respond to that. If you combine that with setting standards on fuel efficiency at the level of the European Union, then that process will accelerate still further. I don't think it's for the government to dip into the taxpayers' pocket and pour all that money into projects it thinks will work, because on the whole, governments get it wrong. I think you have to set an honest market framework where these crucial factors like stable environment, clean environment, stable climate and so on are written into the rules of the game. If you do that, then I think you can trust the market to deliver. I think you have to, because ultimately politicians don't get it right. Look at nuclear power. Years of bad decisions have propped up an industry and a technology which probably shouldn't exist today. I think you have to trust the market to get it right, but you've got to create an honest framework, and you've got to create sufficient disincentives and incentives to stimulate the process. But that's really the job of government, not to micromanage, and certainly not to make those kinds of investments.
You've been listening to Zach Goldsmith, Conservative Party candidate for Richmond, who co-chaired the Tory Party's Quality of Life Review. That brings the 300 to 350 show to a close for this week. And for links and references, or to hear the show again, visit the Climate Radio archive at www.climateradio.co.uk.